The first case, the Williams case, Mr. Dunn.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Damon Dunn, and may it please the Court, I'll be arguing on behalf of both Williams Electronics Games and National Union. After a one-month trial, the jury in this case found by clear and convincing evidence that the defendants in this appeal defrauded Williams. And after denying the fraud all through the preliminary discovery and motions in this case, Arrow's brief concedes that there's no doubt that its account executive and Milgray's managers secretly paid cash to one of Williams' purchasing managers in exchange for hundreds of purchase orders. There's also no doubt in this appeal that the defendants benefited from that fraud. And indeed, they reaped over $20 million just in profit. Yet the district court did not apply Illinois' unvarying rule, which ironically this court articulated when National Union was before it in 1994 in National Union versus Wilkins Low, that a defendant that colludes with a fiduciary who breaches his duty and that defendant benefits thereby is under a duty to make restitution. Instead, Arrow and
Could you have asked for restitution from the jury?
We did ask, and in fact, the defendants brought a motion to preclude us from asking for restitution. That motion was argued extensively in the district court, and the district court judge said that its ruling would be we could not present restitution to the jury. It would reserve it solely, and it's an equitable matter, and it would only award net profits, even in equity.
Well, do you think that's correct, or do you think restitution could be awarded for the fraud?
This court's opinions indicate that restitution can be awarded both as a legal and an equitable remedy. And I think that if I wanted to harmonize all of the decisions, I would argue that when you've got this type of fraud, which involves the particularly insidious subornation of participating with a fiduciary, you impart any of those equitable elements. So, under the Lipson decision, I would suggest that yes, the jury could have decided restitution as a legal remedy, and the law of restitution seems to embody agency, law, and fiduciary duty. So, I believe that yes, you can seek it that way.
What standards would you? How would the jury be instructed on the possibility of a restitution remedy? Well, what standards would they be asked to apply?
Well, I would ask the jury to apply the standards that the Illinois Supreme Court and the Illinois Appellate Courts have set down, which is full restitution of all gain, benefits, or profits from the breach of fiduciary duty, irrespective of the plaintiff's loss. And the Reginary case, I think, sets that forth pretty simply. It says it reverses when the district court provided less than full restitution and said, no, you have to go back and you have to disgorge the defendants of all the profits from colluding with the fiduciary, and you have to award it to the plaintiffs pro rata. And I believe that would be the standard. Another case that I think the court could refer to is the Hill versus Names and Addresses case, again an Illinois appellate decision. In that case, there was an out-of-pocket award at law and a restitution award in the form of a constructive trust. Once again, it was a breach of fiduciary duty case. It didn't even involve fraud. It was simply colluding with an interference. And the court and the defendant argued, well, out-of-pocket remedy, that's an adequate remedy at law, which is basically what the district court said in this case, and therefore they can't get restitution. The appellate court reversed abuse of discretion, said no. In Illinois, the public policy is that the people who collude must make full restitution. Otherwise, they can speculate in their fraud, and there's no way to deter them. So it's clearly, I think, an abuse of discretion not to give restitution in equity, and I believe it was an error.
Did the jury, in effect, award restitution in your claim against Garrity?
I believe they awarded actually the opposite, Your Honor, because they're basically saying this is the money that Garrity actually paid to Barrett. This is the money that Garrity made on the fraud.
That's true. Okay, I'm sorry. I withdraw that. Yeah.
I think in Garrity's case, what we asked for was we wanted his commission. Now, I understand, Garrity.
How could Barry have been stealing all this money, taking all these bribes from different people, without healthcare company without the employer knowing about it?
Well, the jury found, obviously, we didn't know. They found that we didn't know the material facts, and we wouldn't have acted. Or if had we known about these kickbacks, we would have acted differently. We would have fired Barry. But as we laid out in the fact section of our brief, it's very difficult. I mean, that's the whole point of fiduciary law. It's very difficult to uncover a fiduciary's corruption. These are bribes which Barry testified are basically passed to him under the table in his office. There's no checks. There's no records. The only way we got Barry to confess was that if after this fraud wound down, he went on to another parts broker, and they paid him by check. Once we subpoenaed the bank records, then we were able to prove that fraud, and we only found out about Errol and Milgrave's fraud when we gave him the other one and confessed. I mean, it's particularly difficult if you're a civil plaintiff and you don't have the weapons of the government in order to wiretap or surveil people, and you can't threaten them with prosecution. You're basically just left to your own investigation.
What about the gift certificates that some of your other buyers received from suppliers? What was their magnitude?
They ranged. Actually, the only buyers who received them were Barry and his assistant. They were the only buyers. The rest of the gift certificates were passed out to, like, the receptionist, people on the line, foremen, some engineers, and they started at like $25. Afterwards, when we made Neff confess and we got the chart, we were able to see that actually for some of the people it had gone up to $500 in gift certificates for a couple of the engineers.
Did Williams have a policy with regard to employees accepting gifts?
We had a policy with respect to buyers that they had to report. And indeed, we asked Barry to certify.
The buyers had to report, but the other people, the foreman, the receptionist?
No. I mean,
but who got the $500?
Engineers. But Barry got more.
Barry got 500.
No, Barry actually in the end got a little bit more.
But an engineer would get $500, what, at Christmas or something?
Right, they were always at Christmas.
Were these cash or gifts?
Gift certificates.
So an engineer would get a $500 gift certificate, and you didn't have a policy about that.
We didn't have a policy about it, and we didn't really know about it. We knew that the fellow from NEP was coming in. He was dressed in a Santa Claus suit, and he had his assistants dressed up as elves. And we knew he was passing out the envelopes. He was a long-standing supplier. And the whole problem was, I mean, the whole reason with the problem with this Rule 50 argument that Arrow is raising is we would be before the court arguing, well, you know, the standard is that we should have known about NEP, but that's not the standard, and that's not the basis for our appeal. The basis for our appeal is these instructions, A, were wrong, and B, they're simply not fixable. I mean, you do not have standing to raise impari delicto or ratification if you are not an innocent party. And this court has repeatedly made that clear. But fraud presumes you're not innocent. And what's more, it presumes that the plaintiff was deceived, and it presumes that the deception injured the plaintiff. And that's why they're mutually exclusive, and particularly in equity.
I wonder about you could have fraud that was ratified afterwards, right? So you could have fraud. It really would be fraud, no question about it. You were deceived and some, but later you find out about the fraud and you decide, oh, it doesn't matter. That would be a ratification case, right? You wouldn't have a quarrel with that.
I would have a quarrel with an express ratification after the fact. In fact, I think that's in our jury.
You would not.
I would not.
That's where ratification
really comes in. Though, you know, even then, it's not really clear to me that Illinois would tolerate it if the defendant isn't innocent. I mean, if you look at the Rapallo case, they kind of argued that there was express ratification, and the appellate court reversed, saying it's abuse of discretion because the defendant actually benefited from the corruption by its agent. So it's not this case, but even then I'm not sure. But at a minimum, we know Illinois requires actual knowledge and an intentional act to accept benefits. In a fraud case like this, there's no benefits to accept. There's nothing to ratify.
So your quarrel is with the should have, or with regard to ratification, it's this Williams knew or should have known. It's the should have known
clearly
has no basis in Illinois law.
Clearly, that we don't believe the should have known has any basis in Illinois law, and we don't believe that that's a fair description of REPCO. We objected to it multiply. In fact, in the jury conference itself, after making several in limine and summary judgment motions, we said that it has, it should be a should have known, and that for whatever reason the district court decided, or should be actual knowledge. I mean, Mr. Funkhauser is in the transcript saying we believe the standard should be actual knowledge, and the district court entered should have known. And this was all an outflow from a misreading of the REFCO case, which clearly doesn't say should have known. Indeed, says that's a bad ground. But I want to go back because I think
should have known would make more sense, though.
Should have known about a fraud?
Sure.
Well, contributory
like
negligence.
You're not paying attention to what's going on in the company.
Well, but that's exactly what this court has said is a bad ground, that you're, that carelessness is not a defense to an intentional tort like fraud.
But this is reckless disregard, isn't it? Isn't that what it should have known?
Well, but it's not recklessness to disregard of this fraud. I mean, this is, it's reckless disregard of...
Well, but you wouldn't object, I take it, if it had said knew or was recklessly indifferent or something like that. That would be proper. It's the difference between recklessness and negligence that is your particular complaint, isn't it?
Not entirely. I think, yeah, we do complain about that. Instructions
REFCO said, you know, if you close your eyes to the fraud, that's like knowledge, right?
A blind eye,
yeah.
Which is like
so
you know about it, but you choose to disregard it.
Closing your eyes to Santa Claus and his elves seems reckless. I mean, you know, I mean, Santa Claus and his elves come into your office and talk to your buyers. That sounds like a little bit more than negligence. I mean, you say, what's Santa Claus and his elves doing there?
But we know, I mean, we knew this fella, and it doesn't relate to the defendant's fraud, which was what Illinois required. Illinois requires that you have notice of what Arrow and Milgray were doing, that they were paying this buyer thousands of dollars under the table, and we decided to ignore that. Now, to put that in an affirmative defense, it basically negates our proof of clear and convincing evidence that we didn't know the material facts, that we would have acted differently had we known those material facts, and we justifiably and reasonably relied on the defendants. And justifiable and reasonable appear four times in the fraud instructions. And the jury found we proved that by clear and convincing evidence. Then they argue you can raise a preponderance of evidence defense saying, well, you didn't sue these guys, or you didn't stop these guys, so we should get away with the fraud, is completely contrary to what Illinois requires. I mean, as this court said, the justifiable reliance backstops that finding of fraud. So in a ratification case like Your Honor describes, if you benefit, I mean, if you defraud the plaintiff, and that since ratification requires an intentional acceptance of benefits under Illinois law, even post facto ratification wouldn't apply. Because an Illinois court would say, where's the benefit in a fraud? There's no benefit to ratify. So even if you got over the, I'm innocent, I mean, even though I admit I, you know, bribed your fiduciary, you would still have to show that you benefited from those kickbacks. So ratification simply requires full knowledge of the facts and a choice to accept or reject the benefits. And that's the Illinois formulation. And in pari delecto, it's just frankly mutually exclusive. You can't be, as this court has repeatedly said, equally involved in a fraud upon yourself. That's why when the Illinois court and this court have examined the unclean hands defense, which is sort of an equitable variant, they say that the defendant has to prove that the plaintiff defrauded the defendant in the very transaction at issue. There's multiple cases on this, which are cited in our brief. Here, the jury found exactly the opposite. They found the defendants acted in bad faith, i.e. defrauded Williams. And the Illinois courts say it's very clear that in pari delecto does not apply under those circumstances. As far as the Milgray...
So your basic argument is the instructions are all screwed up, they're all a hash.
That is the fundamental argument, but before that, these instructions can never be given. I mean, they were wrong, but the reason they were wrong was, I think at the bottom, everybody realized, you can't say we didn't know about the fraud. That's not a defense. Because we've already proved we didn't know about the fraud in our prima facie case.
Well, if I understand, you're complaining The impari delicto instruction is incorrect. The ratification instruction is incorrect, just as a statement of the law on those subjects. But in addition, they're not consistent with the...
There's not a single...
The instruction of the jury and the... On fraud and the jury's findings.
There's not a single Illinois case that has recognized these defenses to fraud in any context. This is all novel defenses that Illinois just doesn't recognize and could not recognize the way fraud has developed in this state.
If Williams was paying more for what it was getting because of Berry's fraud, wasn't there anybody at Williams that would have known that?
As we pointed out, the evidence showed that what Berry was doing was he's placing spot orders with other distributors so that our systems reflected all the prices were uniform. And that's why we couldn't catch it. And, I mean, the computer systems show that we're paying $10 for this widget from Arrow, and we're paying $10 from, you know, four of its competitors, but Berry is the one setting the price, and that was the
thing. But you have a real problem with your damages, right? Because the jury evidently didn't think that... I mean, because this is separate from the, you know, the business of the... But in their findings with regard to Garrity, didn't the jury indicate pretty clearly it didn't think that Williams had actually been overcharged?
I don't think so, Your Honor. First, well, the jury never considered restitution. So we don't know... I mean, they used the wrong standard. But second, the Garrity evidence wouldn't apply to Milgray at all. And Milgray's person admitted they overcharged by over 10%, and Arrow was charging more. I think where the jury went wrong was because the instruction said you can't consider Arrow and Milgray with Garrity. You can only consider Garrity. And Garrity wasn't really the guy doing the overcharging. He was just the guy passing the bribes. So the jury was really precluded from looking at our overcharging evidence with respect to two defendants, which the court said don't consider them. I'm way into my rebuttal time, so
okay.
If Your Honor, let me conclude. I'd just like to say that I think what the court should do is excise the offending verdict, enforce the fraud verdict, and order disgorgement in full restitution, as an Illinois court predict. We would not ask for a duplicative recovery with respect to the statutory claims, but we do urge their reversal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dunn. Mr. Mattson?
May it please the court. Eric Mattson on behalf of Defendant Arrow Electronics. After hearing the evidence in this case for nearly a month...
Yeah, but you have a really serious problem with your instructions. They're terrible. They're terrible. You cannot have a should have known in a ratification. It's just impossible.
Your Honor, even if that instruction were erroneous...
Don't give me the word. Don't give me the subjective. That is an erroneous instruction. You want to argue that it's not erroneous? Go ahead.
Your Honor, what I do want to argue is that the...
Well, let's get it. It is erroneous.
Your Honor,
let's get clear on that.
The ratification instruction was imperfect.
It was erroneous. You cannot instruct... There is no concept of negligent ratification.
That is true, Your Honor. I'm not entirely sure I would agree that the jury... would interpret the phrase "should have known" in the same way a lawyer.
We never know how juries interpret instructions, but you cannot give an instruction on negligence when the standard is either reckless or knowing or what have you. You can't.
In addition to the ratification instruction, Your Honor, the jury was instructed on in pari delicto.
The pari delicto instruction is no good either because look, it allows the impari delicto to be proved by either of two routes. One is that Williams management knew or was recklessly indifferent to Barry soliciting kickbacks. That's fine. The other is Williams management was aware of a general practice of bribery of its buyers by its suppliers. Now, is that the Santa Claus stuff?
No, Your Honor. It's
a
combination of a wide variety of evidence that the jury found showed that Williams turned a blind eye
but
to payment.
But does that include the gift certificates?
That's one of the things, Your
but
Honor.
But it's not clear whether gift certificates are bribes.
I don't know that the jury needed to be instructed on whether gift certificates were bribes, Your Honor. The jury is entitled to apply a common sense understanding to the word bribe, which connotes
wrongdoing. Well, suppose you give a $10 tip to a head waiter for a good table. Is that a bribe?
Probably not, Your Honor. Arguably, yes. But here we're not talking about a $10 tip to a head waiter. We're talking about many, many thousands of dollars.
No, but that's the Barry thing. Look, I mean, that's what's so terrible about this instruction. Number two, Williams Management knew or is recklessly indifferent to the fact that Barry was soliciting. That's fine. But then you throw in a one as an or. Or Williams Management was aware of a general practice of bribery by its supply. Now, that the suggestion to the jury is that's something else. That's some other animal. So you have Barry bribes, and then you have something else. And they say, oh, that's supposed to be the Santa Claus. Well, it's terribly confusing.
A couple of points in response to that, Your Honor. I certainly will defend the in pari delicto ratification as a correct statement of Illinois law. It's taken from both the Refco case and Stewart Park and the Indeca case that we cited in support of
the
that instruction.
The problem is not the definition of the doctrine. The problem is the specification of what evidence would be sufficient to establish it.
Williams did not object to the instruction on that ground, Your Honor, and has waived any objection to that portion of the instruction. In fact, Williams' objection to the in pari delicto instruction was rather tepid. The main objection it raised was that, as drafted, the instruction said that Williams was aware of a general practice of bribery. Williams objected that it had to be Williams' management that was aware of a general practice of bribery, and the judge, in response to that objection, included that requirement, that we had to prove that Williams' management was aware of a general practice of bribery of its buyers by its suppliers. Now, we're only talking about a handful of buyers here. This is not a huge company. We're talking about maybe two or three or four or five buyers at any given time at Williams. So we're not talking.
How do you respond to Mr. Dunn's point that the jury's verdict is inconsistent because it found fraud, but then in finding ratification and in pari delicto, it contradicted its finding?
I have two responses, Your Honor. First, Williams, in its reply brief, disclaimed any effort to say that the jury verdict was inconsistent. It said we've never argued that the jury's verdict was inconsistent.
Yes, I know they say that, but that's because, as he said in his closing, which is, I mean, not going to get, He wants to end the case now. He doesn't want a remand. He wants us to adopt the jury's fraud finding, disregard ratification in pari delicto, and enter judgment, you know, for full restitution. Now, if we don't do that, we still have the problem that the jury verdict is kind of a mess, because on the one hand they find fraud, on the other hand they find no fraud.
The substantive response, Your Honor, is that Williams is reading too much into the jury's finding on its prima facie elements of fraud. The jury was never instructed that justifiable reliance connotes the absence of recklessness. In fact,
What are you talking about?
Well,
how can you have justifiable reliance? How can you be justified in relying if you're reckless?
Because the way the instruction was phrased, Your Honor, it talked about justifiable reliance on the facts as Williams knew them. The standard that was
suggested. Yes, you can't justifiably rely on something you know if you're reckless. You're not justified.
That's
you're relying, but you're not justifiable. You're not justified in relying.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. The problem is that the jury was not told that.
Well, let's look at the jury. All right, what was the jury told? Where is the...
There is no separate instruction, Your Honor, on justifiable reliance.
Where is the fraud instruction?
SA 334.
Well, where is it in the brief?
Where is it in the brief?
Where can I look at it?
Well, the fraud instruction is at SA 334. I don't know that it's reproduced in its entirety in the brief, but we do quote the portion of the instruction.
Oh, I wish you'd give me the whole thing. Anyway, where is your quotation of it?
Excuse me a moment, Your Honor.
It's in the appendix. appendix?
No, I don't.
What page in the appendix?
That's page 334. On page 35 of our brief, Your Honor.
Okay, page 35?
Yes, Your Honor. It talks about the fact that justifiable reliance was not separately defined, but...
Oh, wait, where are you? In the brief. Page 35, did you say?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, this is not adequate.
In the second full paragraph, Your Honor, it talks about the fact...
Now, where's the instruction, for goodness sake?
Well, the full instruction, Your Honor, is on page SA 334. It's not reproduced verbatim in our brief. But it's cited there at 334 and 335. And the jury was told... The only thing the jury was told about justifiable reliance...
What was the jury instructed?
The
Do
jury
remember what the instruction said about...
Yes, Your Honor. It's right there on page 35. It says that... In terms of justifiable reliance.
Why stop harping on justifiable reliance? I'm asking you, what was the jury instructed about fraud? What were they told that fraud is?
They were told that fraud involves a misrepresentation or omission, that there has to be a misrepresentation or omission of a material fact, that Williams has to justifiably rely on the fact as it knew them, no mention of reckless indifference.
How can you justifiably rely if you're reckless?
I think justifiable you can't, Your Honor, but the jury wasn't told that, and that's why...
It was told, you just read that. You just said justifiable reliance.
On the fact as it knew them.
That's the most extraordinary... Oh, thank you so much. Oh, it's great. Okay.
In fact, Your Honor, Williams proposed an instruction on justifiable reliance that if it had been given, made clear... The justifiable reliance requires only the absence of actual knowledge, not the absence of recklessness. If the jury had been instructed on justifiable reliance and told that recklessness defeats justifiable reliance, we know from its finding on impari delicto that it would have found no justifiable reliance.
We don't know what the jury would have found.
I think we can say with a fair degree of certainty what it would have found.
If I were a juror, I wouldn't have any idea what was going on.
Well, you certainly wouldn't know what justifiable reliance means, and you wouldn't know that it connotes the absence of recklessness, which is the position that Williams
well,
is now taking.
That's so absolutely baffling. Yeah, you say, the instruction says... if you deny that Williams justifiably relied on the facts as it knew them. Okay, it knew facts. Was it justified to rely on them? No, it wasn't justified because in your view they were reckless.
And
so how could the jury find it was justified in reliance and then go on and find that it was reckless?
Because the jury had not read the AMPAT decision, Your Honor. The
I jury, beg your pardon?
The jury was not told... that justifiable reliance connotes the absence of recklessness. We're talking about different standards here.
But how can justification and recklessness sort with each other? I don't get that.
Well, I think if the jury had been instructed on justifiable reliance as Williams now claims it should have been, then we would have a clearer answer. But Williams objected to this proposed instruction on justifiable reliance because they said it's at too high a standard. And another important point, Your Honor, is that this entire argument that you're talking about and that Williams features as its central point on appeal was waived because it was never made before the district court.
No, I don't think that's correct.
Well,
it certainly objected to the in pari instruction and the restitution instruction, and they are certainly arguing They certainly argue that they're inconsistent. Now, what they want us to do with the inconsistency may be improper, which is just adopt the
my point,
part
Your Honor,
of the jury finding they like.
Your Honor, my point is a slightly different one. Williams' argument on appeal and the argument that you were just articulating is that you can't have justifiable reliance and these affirmative defenses coexisting. because justifiable reliance means the absence of recklessness.
Right.
That argument was never made to the district court. Never. Not in the jury instructions, not on summary judgment, not in a Rule 50 motion. Never. In fact, Williams' position was 180 degrees to the contrary.
Rule 50 has nothing to do with this. That's a complete red herring.
Well, regardless of Rule 50, Your Honor, it's a basic rule that to make an argument on appeal, you have to make it to the district court. Williams never told the judge below that you can't...
Look, we start with the fact that you've admitted the rest of the ratification instruction is no good. And they objected to it, and there it is. And as a result of that, there is inconsistency in the jury's verdict.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't see the inconsistency. I don't see the inconsistency, because the import that you're providing to justifiable reliance is not consistent with what the jury was told in the instructions. And neither the judge nor the jury was ever told by Williams that justifiable reliance...
The ratification instruction says that Williams can't recover if it should have known that Barry was taking bribes. And the fraud instruction says that Williams can't recover unless it justifiably relied on what it knew. And clearly, in relying on what it knew, it wasn't justified if it should have known that Barry was taking bribes. I don't see how a juror could put those two things together.
But what you're leaving out of the equation, Your Honor,
I don't know why you allowed the judge to give that ratification instruction. I am just overreaching.
Well, one final point, Your Honor. Even if the court is not comfortable with the instructions as given, it needs to compare the ones that were given to the ones that Williams proposed, which were so far afield from anything supported by Illinois law that there again we have the problem of waiver.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Benson.
Thank you,
Mr. Ferguson.
May it please the Court, Jim Ferguson on behalf of Bell Milgray. In my time this morning, I would like to concentrate on Milgray's second in pare delicto defense, which was based on the microcomp fraud, the allegation being that Gannat and Slupik breaches the fiduciary duty through the operation of microcomp at the same time that they were full-time employees of Milgray gave rise to a separate in pare delicto defense. That was the subject of a separate instruction. And the point I want to emphasize with respect to that separate in pare delicto instruction is that Williams does not challenge the wording or the language used in that separate in pare delicto instruction in the same way that they challenge the ratification instruction. That instruction, in which Judge Gettleman drew verbatim from Supreme Court decisions, required the jury to find that Williams had engaged in the same sort of wrongdoing as it accused Milgray of engaging. Because it does not challenge the language of the instruction, Williams argues instead that the evidence at trial showed that this particular defense should not have been submitted to the jury. It should not have been submitted to the jury because the evidence showed, for example, that Williams didn't benefit from the microcomp relationship, or it shouldn't have been submitted to the jury because the evidence showed that Barry was not Williams' agent. All of these, and I understand Your Honor's point with respect to Rule 50 on the other instructions, but all of these were waived by the failure to make any motion under Rule 50 telling Judge Gettleman, either before or after the verdict, that in light of the...
But I don't know if that's correct, because, he said, we'd like to make the usual motions, and Judge Gettleman said, reserved. Now, that was a kind of shorthand for the fact that, of course, he'd make a Rule 50 motion, but didn't want to waste the court's time repeating what he'd said earlier.
I understand that was an attempt at shorthand, Your Honor, but I would respectfully suggest that the plain language of Rule 50 and this court's decisions interpreting Rule 50 make clear that you need to specify the ground.
But if a judge says to you, fine, reserved, in other words, judge makes clear he doesn't want to hear the repetition, what is the lawyer supposed to do? Say to the judge, well, sorry, judge, you're being too abrupt, and I know I'm going to bore you and annoy you, but I have to recite my Rule 50 motion. I can't just, you know, allude to it.
Even in that circumstance, Your Honor, the what Rule 50 requires at a minimum is that the prudent lawyer did what Milgray and Arrow did, and that is submit a written Rule 50 motion which satisfies the requirements of Rule 50. I respectfully suggest that Rule 50 is very unforgiving. If you do not file a pre-verdict motion under 50A, and you do not file a post-verdict motion under 50B, you cannot later come up with the claim that the evidence was insufficient to support the verdict that was given under a properly worded instruction. As to Milgray's second in pari delecto defense, that is clearly what happened here. Even if they hadn't waived, as to this second instruction, the evidence was plainly sufficient to satisfy the clearly erroneous standard, particularly when viewed in the light most favorable to Milgray. The law is real clear. We're not talking about, does Williams have a right to sell components to Microcomp? What we're talking about is the fiduciary duty that Gannant and Slupik owed to Milgray, which was violated when they secretly operated Microcomp. They sold $10 million worth of components to Williams.
Don't you have, though, a sort of curious parallel to the ratification and in pari delicto argument? That is, Milgray was extremely lax in dealing with Microcomp. Extremely lax. They knew about it for a long time. They told him not to. He kept doing it. They knew about that. And then they give him this generous severance and so on.
Let me respectfully suggest, Your Honor, that the sequence was as follows. Gannant and Slupik start operating the Microcomp in 1987. Milgray discovers it. They tell Gannant to shut it down. Afterwards, and at the time, by the way, Microcomp was not being used to sell components to Williams or any other Milgray customer. In 1991, the evidence shows Gannant reinitiated Microcomp. He established his wife as the president and used her maiden name to conceal his involvement. He set up a separate shell company called LG Consulting to funnel the proceeds from the Microcomp sales into the shell company. He used a P.O. box office in Illinois in order to disguise the fact that he was operating the company out of his own office. And he admitted in his testimony at trial, as did Slupik, that they never told Milgray that they were continuing to operate Microcomp in order to sell components to Williams. I specifically refer to 932, 935, 1010, and 1015 as a transcript. Gannant and Slupik, who were Williams' own witnesses, admitted that they never told Milgray that they were using this Microcomp operation to sell components to Williams. And there's no benefit that this enriched them. In 1996 alone, remember, they split the profits 50-50. If they sell the component through Microcomp, they split the profits 50-50. If they sell the same components through Milgray, they got a 2.35% sales commission. So in 1996, Gannant makes $700,000 by selling components through Microcomp.
Didn't they suspect what was going on when they gave Nat, or Gannat, if he likes to call himself that, this very generous severance and release?
I think what you're referring to, Your Honor, is in 1997, after my client, Bell.
After your client what?
My client is Bell Industries, not Milgray. Bell buys Milgray.
Right, okay, that's, we don't worry about
okay.
That. Yeah.
And in January 1997, in March of 97, they give a release to Gannant. There's no question that during the operation of the fraud, the Microcomp fraud, Gannant and Slupik did not disclose to Milgray that they were doing it. They admitted that in the stand. What you're referring to is after the fraud ended, Williams calls up Bell, and this is the subject of our counterclaim.
Right.
They call up Bell, and they tell Bell that they think they've discovered Microcomp, and they think Gannant was using Microcomp to sell Milgray components to Williams. And the question in our appeal from summary judgment on our cross-claim and counterclaim is that enough to establish as a matter of law that Bell justifiably relied, did not justifiably rely on their failure to disclose the truth. And our point on that, Your Honor, is when Williams calls up and says they're using Microcomp to sell Milgray components, we then do a due diligence. We discover that there has never been any Milgray components going to Microcomp, and we prove that to be false. They then, we ask them for more information. They don't have any additional information because Williams is just beginning its investigation. We then, they ask us to keep it quiet until they complete the investigation. We give them the release. And the question posed by our appeal, our cross-appeal, is whether those facts establish as a matter of law that we did not justifiably rely on their failure to tell the truth. Our point is an allegation that we proved to be false cannot as a matter of law.
Yeah, but I don't see how that relates to your position on the release. I understand your position on the release. You gave these guys, or you gave Nat, a very broad release.
There's no question about that. If it wasn't fraudulently induced, then that's the end of our cross.
Well, I didn't know that, but I didn't think you said it was fraud. I thought your position was that he had a fiduciary duty to come clean when you offered him the release.
Yes.
I don't find that persuasive because he's leaving the company and he wants the broadest possible release, so you know he's not harassed with lawsuits. And I don't understand how anybody is going to be able to enforce a release after your position. I mean, every time a senior person leaves a company under a cloud or something, gets severance, but he executes a release and they execute a release, the release isn't going to be worth anything to him because he will have been a fiduciary at the time he signed it, if he's the senior management.
All that's true, Judge Posner. The rule we're arguing for is that the senior manager, up until the point his fiduciary duty ends, has an obligation to tell the company what he's been up to.
But then he can't get a good release.
I understand that. I think the hard luck rule should apply. If he has a fiduciary duty to disclose the fact that he's been defrauding the company, I don't think he should get a benefit because he wants the broadest possible release. I understand he wants the broadest possible release, but if the fiduciary duty means anything, it means that he has an obligation to tell us that he's been selling $10 million worth of components to our best customer at the same time we've been paying him as a full-time employee. If we had known that, there's no question that we wouldn't have entered into the release.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Klebard?
May it please the Court, my name is Ken Klebard, and I'm counsel for Lawrence Gannett and Richard Slupik, who are cross-appellees in the cross-appeal filed by Milgray. Your Honors, when parties enter into settlement agreements that release broadly defined claims, an expectation is created that those claims are disposed of once and for all. For that reason, in Illinois, as a matter of public policy, there's a presumption that a settlement release is valid, and the party seeking
I understand that. What is Slupik's role in the appeal? I don't quite understand. Did he get a release also?
Slupik also received a release 2 months.
But he wasn't as senior as Nat, was he?
That is correct, Your Honor.
He was a salesman
for Milgray, correct, Your Honor, and he was also affiliated with Microcomp. He was terminated 2 months after Milgray was informed by Bell that Gannett was continuing to operate Microcomp, and it terminated him 2 months later. There was about a week after the time he was terminated and the time that the severance agreements were exchanged. But the fact that I think Your Honor has picked up on that Milgray can't get over in this case is that there was no duty to disclose on the part of Gannett and Slupik. They had been terminated, and they were not the ones that asked for severance agreements. It was actually Milgray that insisted on the severance agreement. Nat testified in his deposition, and we cite this testimony in our brief.
Well, Milgray was worried about an age discrimination suit.
Well, there was a threatened age discrimination suit. That is correct.
By both of them or just by Gannett?
The record evidence is that it was only Slupik who...
But Slupik?
Correct,
Slupik?
Your Honor. Yeah. So it was Milgray that wanted the releases in this case. Milgray slid the release across the desk to Gannett and said, if you do not sign this release, you will get no severance. So it was actually, and that's on Matt Slupik, appendix page 146, that testimony. So Milgray can't escape that the fiduciary duty here ended before the severance agreements were negotiated and executed. It's Hornbook law that there's no duty to speak ordinarily. The silence doesn't amount to fraud. And so if in order for Gnanton's Lip to have some duty to make a full confession to Milgray, as Milgray wants, the court would need to find that the fiduciary relationship existed at the time the settlement agreements were negotiated and executed. And the evidence here is that was not the case. I think Your Honor is also...
So you're saying Gnat and Slupik had been, in effect, fired, even though they were still on the payroll when they signed the release?
The evidence with respect to Gnat is that he was terminated on March 31st, 1997, and was told to do certain things, for example, have his accountant review the severance agreement. He had further negotiations with Milgray after that time, and the settlement agreement was signed effective as of March 31st. But I think from the record it's clear that there were negotiations that took place after he was terminated. In Slupik's case, the testimony is that Slupik was fired and the severance agreement was negotiated over a period of about 8 days. So he was already gone. He had left Milgram.
Slupik was actually gone, but Gnat was technically still an employee of Milgray. And he signed the release.
I do not believe that's correct, Your Honor. I think the testimony is that he was told he was terminated on the spot, effective immediately, and then he was presented the...
So he wasn't paid his salary after that.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think, really, the more interesting aspect of Milgray's cross-appeal is that Milgray couldn't establish justifiable reliance as a matter of law. Milgray claims in its brief that it needed to have actual notice of the particular facts of the fraud, which is a little different than what it's arguing as an appellee in response to Williams' appeal. It's enough in this circuit that the victim have either acted with deliberate or reckless risk, such as closing your eyes to a known risk or risk that's obvious. The facts in this case, I think, speak very loudly. First, Milgray knew in 1987 that Gnat and Slupik were affiliated with Milgray. It spoke to them, it told them to get out of the business, but Milgray's own employee testified that no one at Milgray ever checked up with them, asked for any representations and warranties in connection with the negotiation of the severance agreement or anything else to establish that the business has ceased. But more to the point, in 1997, 2 months before they were fired, Milgray learned that Gnat was still operating MicroConf and that MicroConf was selling to Williams' customer. That's enough under the formulation of breach of fiduciary duty articulated by Milgray on page 15 of its brief. Two of the three disjunctive elements have already been satisfied. They knew that Gnat and Slupik were operating a competing business, and they knew that Gnat and Slupik were trying to sell to one of their customers. What did they do? They made a decision not to ask questions. They claim that they did their own due diligence. What kind of due diligence is it when you don't ask questions of Gnat and Slupik, which they had the opportunity to do? The cases talk about, in examining justifiable reliance, the party's relative experience and their access to the facts. Milgray could have asked Gnat and Slupik about MicroConf. It could have asked for representations and warranties in the settlement release, but it chose not to do so. And the court should not reward, or the law make that, should not reward Milgray for its failure to investigate in this case.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Cleveland. We have to affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Dunn, how much time does he have? 3 minutes? Three?
Well, it's clear the court knows what I want, so I'll just talk about the reconciliation of these verdicts. The fraud verdict required that Williams...
Well, what about Mr. Mattson says that you did not object to the in pari delicto, or at least your one objection about Williams' management was taken care of by the judge?
We actually had two objections. One's in the pretrial order, one's in the supplemental appendix that was done the night of the jury conference. I believe both of those objections are very thorough, and our objection to the Milgray separate defense incorporated those objections. I think we objected up and down the line to that instruction. And the reason is very clear. If you look at the ratification instruction, it says, should have known about...
Yes, ma'am. I'm talking about the in pari delicto.
I know, and I'm going to tie that in.
Well, we've been through the ratification business.
I want to show the difference, Your Honor.
We know what the difference is.
All right. But it says Garrity, Gnat, and Slupik. The in pari delicto does not. It ties the knowledge to knowledge of third-party vendors, other vendors, even under its reckless indifference standard. Doesn't talk about the knowledge of the fraud that's before this court. And that's the difference. And it says that that's recklessness. But it's clear under this court's holdings, knowledge of warning signals is really negligence. And that's why we objected. You can call it equal involvement, and you can call it recklessness. But if you're talking about knowledge of somebody else and then extrapolating that knowledge to figuring out that the defendants are guilty of fraud, that's negligence under the decisions of that this court. And this court makes it clear that that's not a defense to fraud. And indeed, if you look at Milgrave's cross appeal, you can see that the standard they're arguing for justifiable reliance, if applied to our case, would prove that you can't raise these defenses in an adjudicated fraud. What's more, as this court pointed out in Ash, if you ask, then you fulfilled your obligation. And it's clear that Williams got certifications from its co-conspirator, from the co-conspirator Barry, every year. And Mr. Garrity, when asked why he wouldn't tell Williams engineers or anyone else about the payment, said because he knew Williams would fire Barry. Exactly what the Williams people testified. Therefore, I thank the court for its time. We ask for the release of our brief.
Okay, thank you very much to both sides.